That's me. I look at that and I'm like, whew, okay. I get nervous watching that. That's 1 year ago. That's December of 2016, the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. It's a 3,000-mile race from the Canary Islands to Antigua. The shifts are 24 hours a day, 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 2 hours on, 2 hours off, for an entire race that lasts more than a month. So to put this race into perspective, about 4,000 people throughout history have summited Mount Everest, and about 536 people have been into outer space, and about 470 have crossed the Atlantic in a rowing boat. In the pre-race crisis ops meeting the night before the race, a team of experts gets you in a linoleum-floored room like this, and they sit you down, and they go through everything that could possibly go wrong in a race like this, all the way up to the point, if there's a death at sea, what do you do with the body? And I'm sitting there going, what have I gotten myself into? Okay, so that's all the glitz and the glamour at the start line. And TV interviews are done, and the magazine articles are passed. And now you're out on the water. So imagine yourself where I was, several weeks into this race now. It's when the monotony starts to set in, when you're tired, when your hands have blisters all over them. And we're looking at the weather reports coming in, and we start to see that about 10 days in front of us, we're headed straight into a powerful storm. And you can't acknowledge out there that you might not make it back. You may think it, but you can't say it out loud. And I'm thinking to myself, today's my daughter's birthday, January 3rd, and I'm 1,300 miles away from anything floating in this boat. And we're about to hit this storm. If I had one shot to tell that beautiful girl everything I wanted her to learn from this journey, what would I say? So I sat there in my cabin, and I wrote Olympia a letter on her second birthday. And I started off, I said, my darling Olympia, whatever your ocean is, strive with a spirit of excellence to cross it. The journey, like the sea itself, is bigger than you and will show you that you can't control everything. Even knowing there might be unavoidable storms, start the journey and stay sure of what you hope for. Love, Dad. Think about this from my wife's perspective. She's on shore. She's thousands and thousands of miles away, taking care of this beautiful girl. Heather's my high school sweetheart. We've now been together half our lives. She's my best friend. And she was always, the whole time, surprisingly calm about this race. She was the person who's like, God, you said you'll take care of him, so you'll take care of him. Now just help me out with this little toddler who's full of energy and running around the house, and I think we'll be okay. And then there's my mom. Think about this from a mother's perspective. My mom was probably getting less sleep than I was, and I was doing 2 hours on, 2 hours off. My mom's got her little mobile phone, and it's got a race tracker on it, and it shows you a little dot about the size of Florida in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and that's your boat. And superimposed on that little dot is the weather. And my mom is waking up at 2 a.m., 4 a.m., 6 a.m., looking at this little dot to make sure it's still on the map. And she sees exactly what I'm now seeing. She sees I'm about to get beaten up by a storm. And my mom said, this is maybe the first time in her life where she's not praying for my victory. My mom's praying for my safety. My mom's one of those moms who's got a Bible verse for everything. If anyone else has a mom like that, you do bad on like a spelling test and mom's quoting Jeremiah 29:11. Like, I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord. It's going to be okay. Everything's... And this is the one time in that storm, my mom doesn't know what to pray. My mom's thinking, that's my son out there, God. That's my son on the water. What do you want from me? What do you want me to pray? What I want to share with you today is what led up to that point and what led up to that race. What I want to share today is how God took a hell of a childhood, abuse, abandonment, pain, and how he used those things to get me to that point, and how he redeemed those things in my life. That's why I'm up here today. So when I was a little boy, I was all boy, like Tonka toy dump trucks and dirt and mud and matchbox cars and building forts and bike ramps and stitches and a cape. So as a six-year-old boy, I had this cape, and it wasn't actually a cape. It was a safety pin and a red pillowcase. And that's all I needed. Put those two things together, and anything in the world of a six-year-old boy takes on magical properties. So that was my cape. And the problem was that my dad didn't see me, even when I had the cape on. I was just like any other kid. I was like, Dad, look at me. Look what I can do. Dad, look at me. Dad, do you see me? And I felt like he didn't see me. My dad was abusive. He'd be foaming in a fit of rage. And my brother and my sister and I, we never knew what would set him off. And he would just, it would always end up with something crazy. Dishes shattered against the wall, cops at the door. Even a little thing was like, we were bouncing the basketball at the wrong time. And he ripped it out of my brother's hands and stabbed it with a steak knife. And that was normal for us. That was the storms that were all around our house. And then he would just walk out. He'd be gone for a week. And then another week, and then another week, and then a month, and then 2 months, and then 3 months, and we wouldn't know where he was or what he was doing or when we were going to see him again. As weird as this sounds, I didn't feel a sense of relief when he was gone. I didn't feel like those storms had subsided. What I felt was a longing in my heart, like I was missing out on something vitally important. And I would, as a kid, walk around the house when he was gone, and I would look for parts of him in the house, like a pencil that he'd held, where the wood tip of the pencil would absorb the smell of his hands or his wool cap in the closet. I would just find his cap and bury my nose in it and smell it, just to smell his smell, because I missed him so bad. I missed not having a dad. And even as a six-year-old, do you know what I wanted to do with my cape? I want to give my dad the cape. I knew, like a child knows, that cape makes the wearer brave and courageous and strong. And I wanted to save my dad with that cape. I found out early on that the cape didn't work. And it wasn't actually a cape. It was just a pillowcase and a safety pin. About that time, I started to wet the bed every single night. Every night. And I didn't stop until I was 12 years old. That guy that you just saw. I'm peeing the bed as like fifth grade, sixth grader. That's mortifying. When you're a kid, think about if you have children. It's humiliating. I didn't want anyone to know about any of this. I was so sensitive about it. Not my teachers, not my friends, not my coaches, not my classmates. I didn't want them to know about anything that was going on. And you think I was self-conscious about that, about my bedwetting? When I was 7 or 8, before my dad moved out for good, when I was 12, when I was 7 or 8, my dad was admitted to a mental hospital. He'd call from a payphone at a motel, been gone for months. And me and my brother would hear the phone ringing, and we'd run to the phone so excited. Maybe it's going to be dad this time. Maybe it's dad. Maybe he's going to be on the other end of the phone. And we'd pick up the phone, and it was dad. And then he'd threaten us with all the details of how he wanted to kill himself. That's what he's telling his children. Andrew, my older brother, and I were playing on the neighbor's front lawn. And our neighbor, about the same age, he's like, "Hey, your dad's been gone a long time." And Andrew, he's like, "Oh, yeah, he's at the hospital." And the neighbor's like, "Oh, did he break a bone or something?" Andrew's like, "No, he didn't, not the regular hospital. He's at the mental hospital." And that was like, you did not talk about mental illness. You did not admit to having that in your family. That's dark. It's scary. The kids were really, really uncomfortable with that. And the unfortunate thing is that so were the adults. And adults, what I learned pretty early on is adults don't like to talk about stuff like that. And adults, we don't like to talk about things that trouble us. Because it's kind of like, it's like my bedwetting. We're ashamed of it. We're too proud. We're in denial. We don't talk about it. So it's got a power over us. We don't talk about that stuff. We don't bring it out into the open. So we think we're the only people in the world who could possibly be going through what we're going through at that point. I really thought that all my other friends and all my other classmates were living these perfect lives with white picket fences and tulips in the yard, and here I was with this burden that I couldn't talk to anyone about. And that's what we do as adults with a lot of things. I bet you felt a few of those things in your life. There's a part of each of us that we know deep down that we live in a broken, fallen world. We know it. We feel it. John 15:9 says, "If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. You don't belong to the world." You know what my dad told me? One of the last times I ever saw him, we were driving in the car, and all of a sudden he snapped, and we're in a screaming match. I don't even know what it was about. And he screeches the car over to the side of the road, and he pulls over and unbuckles my seatbelt and pushes me out of the car. And he says, "Get out. I hate you." I'm 17 years old. And he says, "I hope you die." And that was one of the last times I ever saw my dad as a 17-year-old, when he said he hated me. Forget about the world not loving you. That was my own dad. That was my dad telling me that. That's like one of the few people in the world who should love you for no other reason than it's you. It's you. Maybe it wasn't your dad that caused you pain, but I bet there's someone listening who's felt the pain of a broken marriage. Probably gone through that. Breast cancer, depression. I bet someone knows an alcoholic and has felt that pain. Jeremiah cries, "Why did I ever come out of the womb to see trouble and sorrow and end my days in shame? My entire life is trouble and sorrow and shame." Everybody's got trouble that we deal with. That's one of the things I learned. Here's a guarantee from the book of John. It says, in this world, you will have trouble. And that trouble can break you, or it can prepare you. It can mature you. That trouble can complete you. Did you know that there's blessing in difficult circumstances? James says, take joy, brothers and sisters, in difficult circumstances. Take joy. So why didn't that trouble break me? Well, there's this other person in my life besides my dad, and that's my mom. And my mom, this whole time, is like a shining light. My mom taught me all growing up. I watched her rely on hope. Every single thing we were going through, she'd respond with faith. All of my experience, my broken childhood, that's her broken marriage, and she's trying to cover me from all this shrapnel. So what I'm getting, she's getting 10 times worse. And she's still responding with faith and hope. Every single day she thinks, tomorrow's going to be better, tomorrow's going to be better. When I got really serious into rowing, I was pursuing impossible odds. I was trying to make the Olympic team. And it got to a point, I'd been doing it for so long, I had a friend who was just like wanted to shake me and be like, Matt, hope is not a strategy. Hope is not a strategy. And what my mom taught me is that's the difference between Christians. Hope was more than just a strategy for my mom. Hope was the anchor for her soul. She relied on hope. When things got really, really hard, she said, God didn't promise it would be easy. He didn't say he'd roll out the red carpet so we could effortlessly just stroll into our destiny. Jesus said, you're my little sheep, but I'm going to throw you out into a pack of wolves in this world. But he says, hey, little sheep, fear not. Fear not. I'll be right there with you. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will shield you. If you just have faith. Faith, though, doesn't make things easy. In fact, a lot of times it makes things harder. I think that's why Hebrews talks about our lives as a race that requires endurance. Endurance means you persevere through unpleasant or difficult circumstances without giving way. Endurance doesn't mean it falls down at your feet. And endurance is what it takes to cross an ocean. And every single person in this room has some kind of ocean that they have to cross. So how do we get from that messy childhood to this ultra-endurance rowing race? I think maybe start by not being well-balanced and well-adjusted as a kid, and then you can do something crazy like this when you're an adult. I'd actually been training for this race for 15 years, but I just didn't know that I was training for this race the whole time. I started rowing as an 18-year-old, a walk-on in college. A walk-on is when you're not a recruit. First strokes of my life I took as an 18-year-old. I was a little rough around the edges, and I was pissed off. I mean, I was angry. That was when I was 18. 17 is when my dad shoved me out of the car. At that point, I felt, as soon as I started rowing, almost from day one, I just felt like God was going to take me to the Olympics. So I'm like, okay, this is going to be a nice little ride. I will probably be at the Olympics in 2 years from now. And that's not how it works. Here's a brief window into what Olympic training looks like. Most people are familiar with running terms, not so much with rowing. So to put this into running terms, This would be like running, on average, a marathon every single day, training 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, sometimes 6 hours a day for 6 days out of every 7 days. My mom always told me, you got to take the Sabbath off. Take the Sabbath off. You got to recover, relax. Well, finally, this all led up to the 2012 Olympic trials for London. After I'd been training for 10 years, and finally, after all of that work, I went to the trials, and I lost. I got last place. And I was just bawling on the finish line. I felt that so deeply. I just wanted that so bad. I'm like, God, you give me this desire? I thought you were the one who gave it to me, and nothing comes of it. You said, God, if I delight myself in the Lord, you'll give me the desires of my heart. Did I have the wrong desire? God, it says that you speak to us in a vision or a dream. Do I have the wrong dream? What do you want, God? Do I have to remind you of what my dream was? Do you even see me? Yeah, God saw me. God sees you. But it's hard to take joy in those difficult circumstances, especially when you don't know what the outcome is going to be. But that's exactly the point. That's what faith is. Faith is when you don't know what the outcome's going to be. You don't know how it's all going to turn out, and you still take joy in those difficult circumstances. So I kept training for 4 more years on that schedule. 1,460 days, not like I was counting or anything. And this time, this was for the 2016 Olympics for Rio. This was just over a year ago. I'd worked and worked and worked up to the point where I could sit on a rowing machine, the same one that you go to the gym, Concept 2 rowing machine. I could sit on that thing for 2.5 hours, a marathon, and hold a pace faster than most in-shape people could do all out for 1 minute. I'd won the U.S. National Championship in the single scull. I'd finally made it to the United States Olympic Training Center. And this time, after 14 years, I finally made it to the trials, and I lost again. After 14 years, and you got to be a pretty positive person in a process like this. You got to just like take the good and the bad. But do you know what it's like to go back to the office? Rowing is an amateur sport. You don't get paid to do it. You got to have a job to like pay for training and racing and equipment. And you go back to the office, and there's those people who just don't get it. You've gone through the hardest thing, and like it's like cut you real deep, and they're like, hey. Weren't you at some little canoeing race or something? How'd that go for you? And I'm like, it wasn't canoeing, it was rowing. And it wasn't a little race, it was the Olympic trials. And it didn't go so well. But as a rower, you can eat whatever you want, so I'm going to go have like a half gallon of chocolate ice cream and think about this. So 2 months after the Olympic trials, I'd given up rowing. I thought that was the end of the journey. And I'm like, okay, God, we'll make something positive out of this. I thought you were going to take me to the Olympics. I don't know if I can go 4 more years, but 2 months after that is when I heard about this ocean race. Imagine that conversation with my wife. Hey, Heather, what do you think about me, I don't know, rowing an ocean? She was surprisingly on board with it, but she knew it would be just as hard for her as it would for me, because she was going to be back at home, single parent, taking care of this little 2-year-old girl. So it wasn't just me going out and doing this race. It was both of us doing this race. And there's a lot more conversations there, but we'll get past that. So, all right, fast forward. Here we are in the first few days of the race. This is our team. We're all big and strong. And after months and months and months of all these safety at sea courses and navigation classes, team bonding, TV interviews. We're the heavy favorites in this race. People are saying we might be the best ocean rowing team in history. And even within the first few days, we're already down. We're in second place by about the distance of a marathon. So what happened is my body started to shut down because of seasickness. My body's like, I don't think I like this. I'm not a marine mammal. This is not my environment. And it actually got really, really serious. I went 30 hours with no food and no water. My mouth is all dry. My lips are like almost so cracked they're bleeding. And then I go for another 24 hours with no water. And my body is just, my forearms are cramping up and my hands are shaking. And I'm just leaning against the cabin wall. And it goes another 20 hours with no water. And this is getting bad. This is life-threatening by that point. We had 2 weeks or 2 minutes of satellite phone calls. And I remember whenever I'd call Heather and Olympia, I always had to sound strong. Heather's like, how are you doing? And Olympia, even at two, is like, Daddy's rowing an ocean. And you can't sound bad on the phone when you hear that little girl's voice on the other end of the phone. Daddy, how are you? I'm good. I'm good. I'll never forget that phone call with my mom. Because I call my mom and she's like, Matthew, how are you? The same thing with my mom. I'm good, Mom. I'm good. Moms know. Moms see right through that. If you're a mom, you know what I'm talking about. Mom, almost in a scolding way, she's like, Matthew, she asked me again, how are you? I'm sitting there just holding the phone up by my shoulder. I said, Mom, I'm tired. And she knew. She could hear it in my voice. She knew it was bad, but she took it from there. She said, Matthew, we're all so proud of you. We're so proud of you. You can do this. If not you, then who? He gives strength to the weak and power to the powerless. Those who trust in the Lord will find new strength. Of course, my mom has a Bible verse for this one. Mom, can you stand up for a second, please? If you're a mom, just stand up. All the moms, stand up. All the moms. Parents, the words you speak over your children are powerful. Your prayers are powerful that you speak over your children. I started holding down food, just tiny little bites at a time, and tiny little sips of water. A few days more and a few days more, and then I'm like, oh, okay, I'm getting my strength back. I'm starting to feel like the old me. Day by day, I'm getting stronger. We're about a week in by that point, but we turned that deficit completely around. We weren't in second place anymore. We were in first place, and we start moving out further and further and further, mile after mile, week after week at this pace. We'd opened up a lead of several days on the second place boat, and we're just getting further out in front. And I really started to feel like this is the time when God's going to redeem all these things in my life, everything I've been doing for the last 15 years. This is how God's going to use it all, finally going to set me up for victory, finally going to make me a champion. Because at that point, we started to see something really exciting. Not only could we win the race, if everything went perfectly, we might just be able to get the world record for the fastest ocean crossing in history. But everything would have to go perfectly for that to happen. We just needed the wind to keep on blowing us east to west, just pushing us along in the direction of the finish line, and we could just make it. We're about 900 miles from the finish line at that point, and then that's when we saw the storm developing. It's like 10 days in front of us, 900 miles to go, and a few days later, it wasn't looking any better. In fact, it was looking worse. But I wanted that record so bad. I wanted it so bad. Here, I'm just using all this strength I've been developing for so long. We needed to bank extra miles. We knew we were going to get pounded by this storm. So I start skipping rest sessions. Instead of rowing 2 hours at a time, I'm rowing 6 hours at a time. Rowing for 18 hours a day instead of 12. Just pushing, pushing, pushing. We'd have to average a little over 70 nautical miles a day to just get the record. 70 miles a day. And that's what we were doing in good weather. And then on January 12th, the storm hit. Job 26:12 says, "By his power he churned up the sea." We got pounded by waves so hard it threw our 2,000-pound boat sideways like it was a bath toy. We had to go 70 miles, and we averaged 46 that first day. We're already at a huge deficit. But even then, I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to give up. I dug deep down. I was giving it everything I had. And the funny thing is that the worse the conditions got, the harder I was pushing. All of that self-sufficiency started to creep back in. My effort, my strength, my power, me. And God's like, "You still think you're the one in control? You want to be the one in charge?" The second day of the storm, Angus came out of the stern cabin. He was looking at the weather instruments, and he said, "Guys, I have bad news. In the last 5 minutes, we've gone 1,000 meters backwards. I was giving it everything I had, and we're getting blown backwards." We went a total of 31 miles that day. And at first, I was in disbelief. Because I felt that this is God finally going to give me that one thing that I wanted, that one dream. I tried so hard to do everything right, to put in the training. And I was adding up the numbers, and I saw what was happening. Because by that point, I'm sorry to say, but we would have had to go like 90 miles a day for the last 4 days to get the record. And I was angry with God. I was mad. "God, I thought you were strong and mighty. I thought with you all things were possible, and here I am going backwards. Can you not control this? The wind and the waves? Is that too much for you?" I finally sat there and I was like, "I'm not strong enough. I'm not strong enough." I remember my mom on land. She's sitting there looking at this storm. She's like, "God, I don't know what to pray. What do I pray?" And the verse that came to my mom was Zechariah 4:6. "Not by strength, nor by power, but by my Spirit. You know where that word Spirit comes from? It comes from the Hebrew word ruach, which means wind. God's like, hey, Matt, do you finally acknowledge that you're not strong enough? Took us a while to get here. We took the scenic route, but at least we're on the same page now. That was a little bit longer journey. Okay, let me take it from here. Watch what I can do. That wind shifts 180 degrees. It's now a direct tailwind, blowing us along so fast, I could just hold up my oars into the wind without even rowing. And we're getting blown along like four times faster than we have to go. We went 89 miles, 91 miles, 92 miles, 89 miles. We didn't just win the race. We set the Guinness World Record for the fastest ocean crossing in history. That's God. That's God. And a few feet from the dock, we had these flags and these flares, and we're celebrating. And I reach down to remove the tether from my safety harness. And my hand grazes up against the waistband of my shorts. And on my waistband, there's a safety pin. And I'm holding this American flag, and I look at the safety pin, and it brings back that memory of when I'm a little kid. And I took that flag and I put it around my shoulders. And I fixed it with the little safety pin. God says, I'll give you beauty for ashes, joy instead of mourning, a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. I'll repay you for the years the locusts have eaten. I will restore twice as much to you, you prisoners of hope. This is what God does. This is what he was doing on the cross. He redeems all things. But then when we land, I get off of this boat, and there's my wife and my beautiful daughter after not seeing him for that long, and my legs were so weak I could barely hold up the weight of my body. I'd lost 40 pounds in 35 days. And I couldn't even walk in a straight line. Finally, on solid ground, I felt like I was moving around. And I went up to Heather, and I just collapsed in her arms. And I'm looking at my daughter, and the look in her eyes opened my eyes. She's looking at me, and Heather goes, I think the flag is too bright or something. The colors are like weirding her out. I was like, she doesn't know what I've just done. And she doesn't care. It's just her daddy there. And she's just happy to see me because I'm her dad. God doesn't need us to be superheroes. We have such a tendency to ask, what can I do? What can I do? But Jesus says, this is what I have done. The ultimate laying it all down is what Jesus did for us on the cross. And you know, anything you've gone through, any pain you've suffered or any trials you've felt, Jesus can relate to that and he can sympathize with that. He can feel it. He was fully God, yeah, but he became fully human. So that we could see our own sufferings in him. Jesus has been angry. He's been tired. He's had blisters on his hands before. He suffered when he was tempted, so he's able to help those who are angry or tired or tempted. And even Jesus, when he's on the cross, in his moment of maximum suffering, when he's at the limits of his endurance, what does he say? He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's Jesus saying that. So if you're feeling that, Jesus has felt that too. Something's tugging on you today. if you feel like you have the weight of the world on your shoulders, or you've got that dream or that desire or that ocean that just seems vast and scary and overwhelming and unattainable, and you don't know how it's all going to work out, the Bible tells us that the way we respond is by faith. Let's pray. God, thank you for how you're working on each one of our hearts today. God, a lot of us are like David, and we're saying, God, how long am I going to have to wrestle with my thoughts day after day? We're like Sarah, and we're saying, God, you put this promise in my heart, and it's just not happening. God, where are you? Some of us, God, feel deep down ashamed, like there's no way you'd want to love someone like me if you knew everything I'd done, if you knew how many times I'd failed. God, let us remember that you have blotted out our sins like a mist. You tell us it's okay. Return to me, for I have redeemed you. God, let us remember when you say that vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens toward the goal, and it will not fail. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. God, you didn't call us to be slaves of fear. You gave us a spirit of power and love and of self-discipline. So let us go out today with hope and joy in whatever difficult circumstances we're failing. But let us go out with humility, because we know, God, that no matter how strong we are, it's never, never strong enough. But when we rely on your strength, God, all things are possible. Amen.